What's University Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. President Obama delivers a national address on terrorism. Speaking late Sunday from the White House, Mr. Obama said authorities are still gathering facts about last week's shootings in San Bernardino, California, in which 14 people were killed and more than 20 wounded. But he said there is no evidence yet that the two shooters were part of a broader terrorist network overseas. Mr. Obama promised the U.S. military will hunt down terrorist leaders in any country where they hide.
The strategy that we are using now, airstrikes, special forces, and working with local forces who are fighting to regain control of their own country, that is how we'll achieve a more sustainable victory.
Mr. Obama called on Congress to make sure no one on a no-fly list can buy a gun. And he said again that the law must make it harder for people to buy assault weapons. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad criticized Britain's entrance into the U.S.-led coalition attacking Islamic State militants in Syria, saying the airstrikes are illegal and will fail. In an interview published in Britain's Sunday Times, President Assad said the Islamic State group cannot be defeated by airstrikes alone, and that the only strikes that have been effective are those Russia has done since launching its Syrian campaign in September. Britain expanded its involvement in the U.S.-led coalition last week. Rival factions in Libya's ongoing civil war say they've reached agreement to end a political deadlock that's crippled the country for years. If approved by the parliaments of the internationally recognized government based in Tobruk and its opposition in Tripoli, the deal announced in Tunisia on Sunday will resolve a crisis that has divided the country since the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi. This is VOA News. 4 months after announcing he was battling cancer, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter told members of his church in Plains, Georgia, there were no signs of the life-threatening disease. Speaking by phone to VOA, Maranatha Baptist Church member and close Carter friend Jill Stuckey said the former president told a crowd of several hundred that medical tests conducted this week did not show signs of the melanoma he was diagnosed with earlier this year. Mr. Carter said he would continue to receive a new treatment that's part of a promising class of drugs that harness the body's immune system to fight cancer. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is in Ukraine for a visit aimed at pushing the Kiev government toward continued reforms, while seeking to reassure it that war in Syria has not diminished Washington's support for Ukraine's pro-Western ambitions. Mr. Biden will meet with President Petro Poroshenko Monday before a highly anticipated address to Parliament Tuesday. During the two-day visit, Mr. Biden is expected to review Ukraine's recent anti-corruption efforts, including tax reforms, ahead of formal U.S. approval of a third $1 billion loan guarantee. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejected U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's warning that a collapse of the Palestinian Authority could have consequences for the security of Israel. Speaking to the Brookings Institution Sunday via a video link, Prime Minister Netanyahu said Israel will not be a binational state. He also said the Palestinian Authority is continuing incitement against Israel. Secretary Kerry said both sides need to renew efforts for peace talks. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility for an explosion Sunday in southern Yemen that killed the governor of Aden province and several of his bodyguards. Aden is a key battleground in Yemen. Houthi rebels took control of the capital Sana'a last year before sweeping into Aden and forcing President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to flee to Saudi Arabia. The United States continues to monitor conflicting reports about the fate of Taliban leader Mullah Akhtar Mansour, but is skeptical a clear picture will soon emerge. Ayaz Ghul reports.
After days of widespread reports that Taliban leader Mullah Akhtar Mansour had been seriously wounded in a gunfight with rival militant commanders, the Islamist insurgency released a voice message from its chief to prove he is alive. In the message released Saturday, Mansour rejected reports of his death in a shootout in neighboring Pakistan and of rifts within the Taliban as propaganda from the Afghan government and its intelligence agency. Ayaz Ghul, Islamabad.
Jews around the world have begun celebrating Hanukkah, an eight-day festival that commemorates ancient miracles and symbolizes triumph over oppression. The holiday began after sundown Sunday with families gathering to light the first nightly candle of a ceremonial candelabra and to exchange gifts. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, December 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan rebels say phase one of their advance team will be in Juba this Friday.
We have gotten a written confirmation from the IGAD countries and the IGAD Plus, the Troika. They are actually the one funding the implementation of the agreement, including paying for the advance team to Juba, their accommodation, also their accommodation and transportation to all the 10 states.
Ezekiel Logat-Kuov is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the SPLA in opposition. Kim Lewis will bring us up to date on the Paris Climate Change Conference, and Steve Aragona will tell us about meals that are good for the climate and an Ebola survival study in Liberia.
What we need to find out, which is very important, is what are the long-range complications as well as other follow-up information on survivors.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. The International Conference on AIDS and Sexually Transmitted Diseases in Zimbabwe and a new book explores Michael Jackson's musical and cultural impact. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman Sports and our Listener of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan rebels, loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar, say phase one of their new advanced team of 262 people will leave Gambela in Ethiopia on December 11th for Juba and the 10 states of South Sudan. Phase two will follow on December 18th, 21st, and 22nd. Ezekiel Logat-Kuov is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. He says the leader of the team will be General Taban Deng Gai, chief rebel negotiator. The rebels first announced their advance team will go to Juba on December 1st, but that did not materialize because of what was called then logistical problems. Now, Gal-Kuov says those problems have been taken care of by the international community, including plane tickets and accommodation for the delegations.
We are having close to 600 people. They will be going to Juba, and they will be led by our chief negotiator, General Taban Deng Gai. The first team will start leaving from Gambela, Ethiopia. They are all in Pagak, South Sudan now. They will be leaving from Pagak, South Sudan to Gambela, Ethiopia, and they will take off from Gambela, Ethiopia to Juba. The first team will take off on December 11th, 2015 at 7 a.m. And this team also will be led by General Taban Deng Gai. The others will also join in 2 days' time.
Ezekiel, what will be the job, what's the purpose of this delegation that's going to Juba? What are they expected to be doing there?
Well, we have people who will be involved and engaging the government in the implementation of the agreement, setting up forces, the cantonment sites of all the forces. The transitional government of national unity will also be established, the selection of the ministers, also the governors, and the reconstitution of all the institutions of the government in South Sudan. The general implementation of the agreement is what they are going for. That's why the team is being led by a chief negotiator. While they are in Juba, they will be engaging former president of Botswana, who is the head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, His Excellency Festus Mohai, and they will also be discussing with the government, engaging the President of the Republic, Salva Kiir Mayardit, and many others.
The last time we talked with you, we were given a time that the delegation was to go to Juba. That never materialized. Later, we were told it was due to logistical reasons. Have you taken care of those logistical reasons, and what are they?
Well, definitely, it is not us as we. It is actually the IGAD. The IGAD countries and the IGAD Plus, they are the ones doing the arrangement. For us, we have been ready 2 weeks ago, and that's why we have gotten a written confirmation from the IGAD countries and the IGAD Plus, the Troika, USA included, UK included, Norway is included, and also China. They are actually the one funding the implementation of the agreement, including paying for the advance team to Juba, their accommodation, and also their accommodation and transportation to all the 10 states. So now they have confirmed in writing that flights are booked for the 11th of December, and the first team, the 262, will be taking off to Juba on the 11th December. It is confirmed and in writing.
So you have informed the government in Juba of your delegation's arrival?
Yes, they are ready. They are also in communication with us in writing. It is not verbal. They have written to us since November 26. They were ready to receive us if the IGAD provided the logistics.
Ambassador Ezekiel Gatkouf is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. He was speaking with me from the rebel headquarters of Pagak in Upper Nile State, South Sudan. The Liberia-U.S. Clinical Research Partnership, known as PREVAIL, has launched a study of Liberians who survived the Ebola virus disease within the past 2 years. Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. He says the purpose of the study is to determine if survivors develop immunity that will protect them from future Ebola infection and whether previously Ebola-infected individuals can transmit the disease to their close contacts and sexual partners.
What we need to find out, which is very important, is what are the long-range complications as well as other follow-up information on survivors. So the purpose of the study is to try and determine just exactly what some of the potential long-range adverse events that are associated with having had Ebola infection. So, for example, there have been reports that have been anecdotal about persistent joint pain, about neurological symptoms, about memory deficits, about a variety of other things. So, since we have so many people who now are survivors, we started a study of looking at 1,500 survivors in Liberia and 6,000 of their contacts or the contacts of the contacts to determine what the potential symptoms are. In addition, we're doing studies such as collecting semen from the men to determine how long the virus might persist in seminal fluid. So the real purpose is to see what the long-range follow-up of these people are. Are they possibly infecting their sexual partners or not? And how are their symptoms? Did they cover completely, or do they have lingering signs and symptoms that last for a considerable period of time?
Doctor, given that Ebola has traumatized Liberians and probably stigmatized those who contracted the disease, has it been easy or difficult to get volunteers to enroll in the study?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, I think that they feel that they want to get that information because it would be important to them. And I think the results of the survivor study might ultimately wind up diminishing stigma when the follow-up studies show that they actually go back to being completely normal and that there is nothing to worry about with them. So I think it might have the other effect, the positive effect.
So how long is this study going to last?
Until we accumulate the total of 7,500 people, 1,500 survivors, and 6,000 of their contacts and the contacts of their contacts.
So the idea is to reach everyone that contracted the disease in Liberia and their contacts?
Not everyone. 1,500 of them. That's not everyone, but 1,500 is a big enough number to be able to make some statements that would apply to the rest of them.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. He was speaking with me from the NIH outside Washington, D.C. Today's Monday, December 7th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. The International Climate Change Conference in Paris, France, enters its second and final week today, Monday. Viewers Kim Lewis, who is covering the conference, says there was an interesting development on climate and development with some potential benefits for African farmers.
Yes, well, in terms of Africa, I attended the Global Landscape Forum, and they're doing a lot of exciting things in trying to launch new climate and development agendas and initiatives. And there I spoke with the CEO of CGIAR. He was very, very excited about the agreement because if action is taken on that agreement, it could mean a lot of good things for Africa, especially the smallholder farmers, agriculture, and food security.
This climate change and food security, now, how would this work particularly?
Well, how it would work is the CEO of the CGIAR consortium says that they presented various approaches to tackling food security that involved new initiatives in regard to more ambitious targets for the agriculture sector, and this includes landscape and seascape management proposals. What this agreement means, if action is taken on the agreement, and a lot of the participants here are really putting an emphasis on action, they want to see an action plan and they want to see action taken this time. They really do. For instance, this agreement could mean for smallholder farmers lots of initiatives that would really help them out, for instance. And it could mean that there is money available for smallholder farmers, offering them such programs as weather insurance, for instance, climate information, and also something very, very important, and that is a variety of crops that are resistant to flooding and drought, and that's really, really big. So this is what the participants are hoping for. They're looking for some action. They want them to put their money where their mouths are so that they can move on and start helping farmers.
That's VOA's Kim Lewis, who is covering the climate change conference in Paris. The UN climate talks are taking place outside Paris, one of the world's gastronomic capitals. Dining delegates may find menus bearing the stamp of a new chef's organization promoting meals that are good for the climate. VOA Steve Baragona meets the chef behind the logo.
Paris is synonymous with good food, good wine, and good times. At Le Petit Dupin, Chef Francois Pasteau wants your meal to have one more bit of goodness. Good for the climate.
Three times per day, we can do something good for the climate in changing the way we eat.
Pasteau's menus stress, for one thing, fresh, local, seasonal vegetables.
Quality is better, it's better for your health, it's better for the climate because it has not been traveling for a long way.
On the menu today.
So this is the endive, you see. Carrots from around Paris. Vegetable tart, all the vegetable are coming just around Paris. The same for the apple, that's called Reine des Rainettes. I will say 90% of my vegetables are coming just around Paris.
A big part of the good for the climate menu, less meat. Beef especially takes a lot of resources.
The beef needs to eat a lot. We destroy a lot of forest to cultivate this food for the beef.
But it's not about cutting things out of your diet entirely, he says.
That's important to say. It's not to be punished to be good for the climate. It's to have pleasure.
Pasteau builds his dishes around vegetables and then adds the meat.
He's very happy to taste different kinds of vegetable and to eat a bit of meat or fish around.
Just before the Paris Climate Conference, Pasteau started a group to promote what he calls good for the climate menus. Around 50 restaurants have joined.
It's an excellent idea.
Climate expert Alexander Maybeck is with the UN Food and Agriculture Organization.
One of the most difficult things to do is to change consumption attitudes. And the worst way to do it, I would say, is to say you shouldn't do this and or deprive people of it. Giving value to other ways of eating, for me, is probably the best way to do it.
At a climate conference side event, French Environment Minister Ségolène Royal presented Pasteau with an award for his efforts to show good food can be good for the climate. Steve Baragona, VOA News, Paris.
The International Conference on AIDS and Sexually Transmitted Diseases in Africa conference continues in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare. High volumes of ordinary women have been openly visiting this place stands to learn more about HIV/AIDS. Women's rights activist Evervince Mugumbe says she is impressed at the interest shown by women in protecting themselves from contracting the HIV virus.
I am very happy that Zimbabwe has voted ICASA 2015. We are happy in the sense that now we can exchange notes on how far we have gone with mitigation of HIV and AIDS. We are also happy that in the host country, most people are coming up with ideas, their experiences in their own country, and we compare notes as African, that what is the way forward that we can help to mitigate HIV.
And what is the slogan that's being very popular there at ICASA? We see that there are different minority groups like LGBT communities and also sex workers. But you were saying that they are all singing with the same voice. What is that?
The slogan that has made people very especially women and the minorities is on condomizing. Condomizing everything. If you are to have sex, you have to condomize. Because as LGBT, they have to condomize. A sex worker condomize, people living with HIV condomize, even if when you are negative, condomize.
Evervince Mugube is a women's rights activist. She was speaking with Marvelous Nyahuya of Viewers Zimbabwe programmer. In a career spanning four decades, Michael Jackson became a global icon, selling over 400 million albums, earning 13 Grammy Awards, and spinning dance moves that captivated the world. The legacy of the King of Pop is still being explored, even now 6 years after his death. MJ, the genius of Michael Jackson, is the latest work to look into the life of the child star and troubled man. As Faisal El-Masri tells us, author Steve Knapper says despite years of scandal and controversy, Jackson's legacy will be his music. Fifth Lapidus narrates.
Steve Knapper spent 3 years interviewing more than 400 people who knew Michael Jackson, relatives, friends, record executives, and celebrities.
He was a genius on many levels, but the three key ones to me were his intuitive singing style, the way he put in those rhythms, and secondly, the way he innovated dance at a time when really there wasn't a lot of dance in pop culture. And then thirdly, his songwriting. I think he doesn't get enough credit for being a great songwriter.
Michael Jackson's rise to superstardom really began in the late 1970s when he started collaborating with legendary record producer Quincy Jones.
It really was Quincy bringing a whole team to the studio, and sometimes they would work on Michael's songs together, and other times he would bring in a prominent songwriter, Rod Temperton, who wrote Thriller and a lot of other great Michael songs.
And it was Thriller, released in 1982, that propelled Jackson across pop music's racial barriers.
It's close to midnight, something evil's lurking in the dark.
Disco, which had been huge for 3 or 4 years, had just crashed. And so when Michael came along with Thriller, radio stations and MTV and other entities within the music business were segregated, so it was black artists were on urban, quote-unquote, urban radio stations, and white artists were on either rock or top 40 or other kinds of radio stations. And so Quincy and Michael and their team, specifically decided that they wanted to make music that was for everybody.
Collaborating with white musicians was another way to break the racial barriers in music. Jackson did that with former Beatle Paul McCartney on The Girl Is Mine, and 4 months later with heavy metal hero Eddie Van Halen.
The doggone girl is mine.
It was the way for Michael to, as an African-American artist, to kind of get onto white pop stations, if you will, using Paul McCartney.
Because the doggone girl.
And once he was able to make that move, all the rest of the songs followed. Later, of course, to get on white rock stations, they employed Eddie Van Halen.
One of Jackson's trademarks was his moonwalk dance, the famous glide that looks like he's moving forward and backward at the same time.
Michael learned that dance from a number of different sources, including himself, but specifically from a group of dancers. Their names were Casper Candidate and Cooley Jackson, and there was another guy named Jeffrey Daniel. He eventually invited a couple of these guys to come teach it to him directly. And I did an interview with Cooley, Cooley Jackson, who kind of explained how Michael kept saying, "I'm not getting it, I'm not getting it. It's a very difficult move to get, and it doesn't click until you work on it and work on it and work on it." And finally, it clicked, and Michael got it.
Jackson also showed that persistence in making sure the words and music clicked. Some of his best songs were years in the making, like Earth Song from the 1995 History album.
What about sunrise?
That was Viewer's Fifth Lapidus reported. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Marco Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with basketball. In an all-Angolan final, Primeiro de Agosto beat defending champions Interclub 69-53 at the Africa Women's Basketball Club Championships in the Angolan capital, Luanda, on Sunday night. Mozambique's Ferroviário de Maputo outplayed Nigeria's First Bank 71-54 to clinch the bronze medal. Nigeria's Dolphins edged the Democratic Republic of Congo's INSS 59-52 to place fifth, as Cameroon's INJS outwitted the Democratic Republic of Congo's RADI 58-53 to place seventh. In athletics, Kenya's former world marathon record holder Patrick Makau clocked 2 hours 8 minutes and 18 seconds to retain his title at the Fukuoka Marathon in Japan on Sunday. Ethiopian Getu Feleke was runner-up. In football, Ugandan Cranes pipped Rwanda's Amavubi 1-0 in the final at the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's SECAFA Senior Challenge Cup in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, on Saturday. Uganda has won the annual event for an unprecedented 14th time. Ethiopia pipped Sudan 5-4 in a post-match penalty shootout following their 1-1 deadlock in open play to claim the bronze medal. Still with SECAFA, Uganda earned $30,000 cash prize for their triumph. Rwanda get $20,000 and Ethiopia get $10,000, all donated by the Rwanda President Paul Kagame. What's more, Uganda, Rwanda, and Ethiopia are among 16 teams vying for glory at the African Nations Championships starting in Kigali, Rwanda, next month. In Senegal, Mali pipped Egypt 1-0 as Algeria and Nigeria drew 0-0 in Group B matches at the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations on Saturday. Algeria topped the group and along with Nigeria progressed to the semifinals. Early on Friday, Senegal pipped Zambia 1-0 and South Africa edged Tunisia by a solitary goal. South Africa and Senegal progress to the last four. Therefore, Algeria, Nigeria, Senegal, and South Africa are in the running for Africa's three places in the men's football contest at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil. Finally, in rugby, South Africa beat Australia 19-14 in the plate final at the IRB 7 Series tournament in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, on Saturday. Kenya lost 33-7 to France in the bowl semifinals. Consequently, South Africa is fifth in the standings with 13 points, while Kenya is 11th with 5 points among 16 teams. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ohuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. That is it for this Monday, December 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ohman, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa that you will have a very, very productive week.
Next on Let's Talk, dieting after the holidays. Is this the New Year resolution for many? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing dieting after the holidays. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.